The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. The first case for oral argument this morning is Christopher Krieger appellant versus the State of South Dakota appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Mark Cotty, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. Austin Voss, also an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Cotty, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes.
Okay, very well. And for the state, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Zinner has the flu bug, and so he will be listening over the internet, but he will obviously not be personally present, but he'll be listening, fully participating in the court's deliberations. So with that, Mr. Cotty, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Please the court, counsel. Members of the Supreme Court, this case is about Carrie Kirkhart. And she was a wonderful, caring person. And the evidence shows that beyond any reasonable doubt. She was a single mother who raised her own son on her own with the support of a lot of friends and supportive family. She defeated cancer. There were numerous testimonials presented during the trial and during the sentencing hearing about the type of caring person she was towards the people she loved and those who loved her. And we could talk for hours about the kind of person that she was, and I'm sure the state will do a fair share of that, but we only have 20 minutes apiece to address this court. And so I'm here today to talk about what this case is not. And I submit to you this is not a case about overwhelming evidence of guilt and harmless error. We know the following for sure. On the morning of March 15th, 2014, early morning hours, at 3:35 and 59 seconds, what has been referred to as the mosque video shows the decedent's SUV pulling in front of the decedent's house.
Mr. Cotty, yes. I hate to interrupt you, but we're on the internet here.
Oh.
Would you mind moving that easel closer to the podium?
I will.
And then you can use the podium and still make your point with your photo.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for telling me, sir. These photos were lifted from video shown during the trial. The ones I have here, the first two, will be from the mosque video system, which the mosque is about two doors down from the Kirkegaard residence at 709 South Garfield. And it looks out across its lawn onto the parking lot of Garfield Elementary School, and the school itself is in the background. Now, at 3:35 in the morning and 59 seconds, the car first enters and proceeds past the decedent's residence. Now, the quality of the videos in this case is very poor. It is very poor. And the stills aren't much better. But when you look at the videos at the times that are listed, you look at the motion of moments before a particular time frame and the motion afterwards, and you're able to see the images with a greater degree of clarity. Now, by 3:36 and 19 seconds, the SUV that had proceeded further down South Garfield and turned into the the Garfield Elementary School parking lot. And it goes to the end of the parking lot to where the side of the building is. And once again, the photo is not good, but when you see the motion, you'll see a car turning around, shining its lights on the headlights on the school building and turning back around. That's at 3:36 and 19 seconds. But at that same instant in time, 3:36 and 19 seconds, surveillance cameras at the Family Market looking south onto Garfield Avenue show other activity. In the picture before you and in the Family Market video, You'll see Garfield Avenue, the same street as the decedent's residence. The Family Market is north of 12th Street, one of the main drags in town, on the northern side of town, and that would be shown in the top of the photograph on the upper right-hand side. And Garfield goes straight north. And at 3:36 and 19 seconds, we see this figure. Once again, it's clearer when you see it in motion, but this is someone on the video shown to be someone on a bicycle.
Could you just raise that up here?
Sure, I am sorry, sir. I certainly can. You'll see on the video.
You want to point out for Justice Jensen exactly where that person is?
Yes.
It's tough to tell.
If you see, it is tough to tell. There is a street lamp in the upper left-hand portion of the video. There's a hardware store on the opposite side of Garfield, across from the Family Market. And you'll see this figure on a bicycle riding north on Garfield at 3:36 and 19 seconds. Now it gets, as if it couldn't get more confusing, the video from the Family Market is an hour off. So when you see, and this was not disputed at trial, when you see a signature of 2:36 and 19 seconds, it's really 3:36 and 19 seconds. A little bit later, at 3:36 and 27 seconds, there's another surveillance camera at the Family Market, and it is pointing north on Garfield, looking in the northerly direction. And once again, this is probably the most blurriest of the bunch, but on the video, when you look at the right, look for the precise time signature, you will see the figure on the bike, which is this blob here near the telephone pole on the far right-hand side of the photograph, proceed at a fairly swift pace north on Garfield Avenue, and then it gets out. The bike goes out of the picture. Coincidentally, or not coincidentally, lots of coincidences in this case that are panning out according to what the video show. There is a house with a lit window. This is 722 Garfield, where the defendant's girlfriend and state witness, Lori Nagel, lives. About an hour or so later, you see the bicycle returning, and the person gets off the bicycle here and walks to the house at about 4:30 or thereabouts. But when you slow this stuff down, and it's really tough.
Mr. Katie, how many blocks away is that from
I would estimate, this on the same, once you get to 12th Street, I would think it's another three blocks, perhaps, 3 to 4 blocks. There are exhibits at trial that were admitted, some were gargantuan. I don't know if they all made it up, have the old package set up and bring it up here, but I would think it's about 2 to 3 blocks south of 12th Street, all on the same street. But once you get 3:36:19, if you can zero in on that, you can go a little bit further and behind, and you get to see more of the path of the bicycle, and you get more of a sense of its motion in action. Now, Detective Hoffman was being cross-examined, and he admitted that the person who is driving a bicycle at this hour and minute and second can't be the person driving that car. Can't be the same person driving the SUV. Now, we attempted to ask for, we requested an alibi defense, and it was denied. An alibi defense coming from a judge, and not just me talking about a lack of proof, would have helped explain the jury options with regards to how to handle this. And I think it was warranted under the circumstances, because the state set a broad timeline of several hours in its notice of alibi, but not a set date and not a set time. And the trial court noted that on the record, noticed the anomaly on the record, and I noticed the state is also advocating, in its appellee brief, it notices that, well, there's an on or about the date of the offense instruction, the date of the offense listed in the indictment, was the 14th. So the defense was given quite a moving target there as to an alibi defense. But one thing is sure, that the state knew. The state knew. They had all this evidence, these videos and things like that, prior to the indictment. They gathered all this evidence up. And they knew at least one exact time that conflicts with two different places of activity. That's 3:36 and 19 seconds. You can stretch it out either way, 3:36 and 20 seconds. It can go either way, but at least know that that minute in time was known because they had all this information. And they knew, tactically, not to use it during trial.
You take the water up there if you want.
Oh, thank you.
You bet.
Officer Mixel, I believe, was the officer who retrieved the videos. He testified briefly, but they didn't play the video. And Detective Hoffman was testifying and didn't look like they were going to ask him to play the video through him. And so we did. And so, and he admitted, as I said, that he conceded that he could not be the same person. And there were other issues in this case about the amount of evidence that didn't necessarily have anything to do with the case that were submitted. I believe the opposing counsel called to attention 297 pieces of evidence, many of which had nothing to do with the decedent's death. But they don't present the video showing someone on a bicycle. The idea of someone driving around on a bicycle was supposed to be a big, unique thing in this case. And the stuff that shows a person on a bicycle was not presented. Now, the argument that comes to counter that is, well, the bike in the video has no reflectors on it compared to supposedly the defendant's bike that does. And we have to think of which bike is the target that they're shooting for here. Because I would call attention to trial transcript volume 10, pages 30 through 31, testimony of Detective Forrester. Now, he presents a picture of a blue bike and a red bike with no stickers on it to Michael Miller, who is a state witness on a couple of issues. And Mr. Miller said, you know, the red bike with no stickers on it looked like Mr. Krieger's bike, but Miller did not identify a blue bike during trial. He reported that the defendant used a black bike, and that's at transcript 8, page 82. And there was so much, there's uncertainty with regards to the bikes that are supposedly used and not used by whomever in this case, because even Detective Forrester, at volume 10, page 31, lines 3 through 4, said he didn't exactly recall much details about the bike conversation with Miller. So that's the foundation, and it's a shaky foundation with regarding to linking a particular bike to my client. Now, another issue that came up is the criminal mind. Now, the defendant, we sought to prevent introduction of evidence that the defendant stated to two detectives that he had a criminal mind. And after having failed that, we tried to mitigate the damage by proposing our own careful instructions. I would refer to the trial court's
face. The comment actually comes from your client, though, originally.
Yes, okay. Yes, it was a statement made by him. And we're not saying that there was a Miranda issue or anything like that. He said it. But given that he said it, I think we have to look at the context of which those statements were in. The first statement, or the one statement to Detective Hoffman, I believe, pertained to prior arrests that he had. The other one concerned statements he made regards to safety advice to his girlfriend. And the appellee characterized them, I believe, as informal remarks. But the prosecutor referred to them in the following way. At first, when we were talking about this stuff in motions in limine, he told the trial court he needed it to establish intent. That's what it's being used for. And he did so twice in his closing argument. Volume 12 of the transcripts, page 88, the prosecutor stated, it is due to the defendant, you know, who mentioned repeatedly, as I said, that he had a criminal mind knowing how to commit a crime. Later, at page 138 of the same volume, Mr. Krieger told multiple officers, I think there were two, but he told multiple officers that he had a criminal mind, suggesting that he could plan a crime, could plan aspects of getting away, and disposing of evidence. I cited in my brief to you some cases, Armstrong and the Banks case, and in those cases, Armstrong was a robbery case, and in that case, the defendant says, I will steal someone's stuff, but I've never hurt anyone in my life, man. And in Banks' case, it was a murder case, and the defendant had said, I'm a dangerous man. And although those clearly are admissions against interest, they don't help. They were admissions against interest that revealed character evidence. And their admission was shown to constitute prejudicial error. And the jury did not hear about Krieger's prior arrest in this case. It was excluded by the court. And there's a whole other part of this case that isn't up here for appellate review, but there was a significant portion devoted towards dealing with a case where, in 2008, where the defendant was accused of rape, was arrested for rape, sat in jail for rape, but the charges were dismissed because later evidence cleared him. Now, this statement, criminal mind, was presented out of its original context regarding those events. And it is being presented as 404 character evidence and its effect, as shown by what the prosecutor wanted to do with it, and said, and showed how he used it in closing arguments. And I believe that's not only inadmissible, but it creates prejudicial and reversible error, as shown by the Armstrong and Banks cases. Now, the state argues in its brief on page 23 that the trial court thought, with regards to the criminal mind statements, that the defendant was not referring to any legal terms of art, and that the jury could interpret these remarks as admissions, and not as anything which related to the existence of a depraved mind or premeditation. And so, if it's equally possible that the information may not be regarded as something material to a main issue in the case, it raises possibilities, not probabilities, that it would be used to figure out the existence of a contested element, the mens rea of the suspect. And that's why they said they were going to use it, and that's how they used it. I think the lack of a connection to a legal definition makes it even less relevant in a case like this. And then the trial court acknowledged it would be prejudicial, but denied instructions designed to minimize it. It said it was going to make careful instructions, but nothing additional was added to it.
Did you propose any instructions, Mr. Cady?
Yes, there were, and you'll find it in the appendix to my brief. There were a number of instructions that dealt with specific mental mens rea requirements that basically
mens rea instruction, does that specifically go to criminal mind?
Yes. Well,
language.
I believe it goes to the intent of what the scientia of what their thought processes are. And so mine basically said, evidence that the defendant described himself as having a criminal mind does not in and of itself mean the defendant possessed a depraved mind. You must consider any such evidence in conjunction with all other evidence presented. And I take the other elements, premeditation, into a similar treating of it. And those were presented, and those were rejected.
To the extent you were concerned about the evidence being used as character evidence, did you ask for a limiting instruction?
I believe no, I didn't ask for a limiting instruction. I was anticipating that when the court said he would do careful instructions later dealing with that, and I proposed my own, that would be the way it would be addressed. So there was no careful instructions devised by the court to do it. And so I thought, okay, I'll come up with something of my own, and I was expecting the court to do something as well, but it produced nothing later in the hearing, and it denied my attempts.
All right, just briefly, you're running out of time, but I want to go back to your first argument on the bicycle. You've gone through the facts, but of course, we're not a jury. And those factual determinations were made by the jury. What is your point? Are you trying to get to the alibi defense?
That's part of it. Was that
the whole purpose of what you went through factually?
Yes, and also showing a lack of overwhelming evidence of guilt when everyone's the thrust of the case is looking for someone on a bicycle, and there's a bicycle driving around 3:36 in the morning near the defendant's girlfriend's house. And the defendant made statements about how he had just been nearly sideswiped by an SUV, and the SUV is on the same street going in the other direction. That's not overwhelming evidence of guilt if he's supposed to be driving the SUV. And that's just part of it, of illustrating that there are lots of coincidences. There's lots of guesswork that goes on in this case, lots of speculation. And speculation can't lead to a verdict of guilt. Speculation should be dispensed with, which is why I also propose instructions on speculation, how to deal with probabilities versus possibilities, and they were denied too. I think that causes us to be denied a fair trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cotty. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
Can I have those?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. Do you want the easel as well?
No.
Can you take the water up there, too? Go on.
May it please the court and counsel. This case is about someone who is trying to game the system. He's smart. He's trying to cover his tracks. And we don't need overwhelming evidence. All we need is the jury to find evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of guilt as to all the crimes. This is a jury question. All these things that you see in here, these are jury questions, questions of fact for the jury. They heard it at trial. They rejected it. It's no more persuasive here today than it was at trial. You can't tell who that bike rider is. There's no face. You can't tell what kind of bike it is, and there's no reflectors on that bike. If you look at Exhibit 99, which is the defendant's bike, which the police went out and located, there are reflectors on that bike. The defendant was riding a bike with reflectors. You can see it in the mosque video. You can see him walking back and forth at 3:30 in the morning towards the victim's house and back towards the victim's SUV. And when Detective Hoffman said it can't be the same person in the vehicle or on the bike that you see here in the fog, he didn't mean that it was the defendant. There's somebody else riding around about out there. But we've got three witnesses who identify the defendant in the mosque video. They're the three people who are closest to him, his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend, and also a good friend of his, and probably the defendant's girlfriend said it best when she said, "My heart just dropped when I saw that video." As far as the alibi, Judge Salter was very careful to look at this evidence in terms of whether there should be an alibi instruction. He gave jury instruction 46. It tells you that for the alibi, he gave jury instruction 16. And it told the jury, he didn't accept the fact that there was an alibi in this case. 24 seconds, less than half a minute, does not constitute an alibi. And he said it does not comport with the evidence. There's too much time that this defendant was wheeling around Sioux Falls and nobody knows where he was. He can't even tell where he was. He tells the detective in his interview, "I don't know where I was. I don't recognize street signs." So the alibi instruction was not something that the court chose to give, and he was very careful about that. All his decisions were very carefully made, and he considered probably every angle and then reconsidered it. As far as the defendant's second issue, which is the character evidence, the court made the call. It was his prerogative. What he saw the character evidence or the state of mind evidence as was an admission against interest. It's a classic exception to the hearsay rule. The defendant said it. He can't take it back. It's the truth. He told these officers that he had a criminal mind. He said it twice. And the court gave the instruction, which I didn't mention in my brief, and I wanted to call the court's attention to. He gave jury instruction 46, which says that an admission cannot be something that the jury convicts the defendant of standing alone. It has to be something that's supported by independent evidence. And we've got independent evidence. We've got the DNA evidence, sperm cell fraction that connects the defendant to this crime. We've got the mosque videos. We got the people who recognized him in those mosque videos. We got the fact that he's always trying to cover his tracks. He's always got a different story that he's telling.
I want to go back to the criminal mind issue. You said that Judge Salter determined it was an admission against interest, which gets you around the hearsay issue.
Right.
State argued at trial that this was went to state of mind. In your brief to this court, you're arguing a little different theory. What was the relevance, or what did the criminal mind statements go to?
It went to the fact that, and I know Mr. Cady thinks it goes to intent, but the court didn't see it that way. And even if it did, there were other instructions defining depraved mind and specific intent. He said it was pure and simple, classic admission against interest. It counts. It's something that he said during his interviews. They were spontaneous remarks that he volunteered and that they were coming in. And that's how the court called it. That's how he saw the evidentiary ruling. And I think that he was very careful to be sure that none of the defendant's prior history came in. And I don't think his remarks were at all related to something from his prior background or a prior case. They're related to this case. He's talking about the street signs. He didn't remember them. He's talking about the fact that if there was a system in the neighborhood to prevent a suspect from hurting somebody else, a community neighborhood watch or whatever, that he could beat it. He could kick the door in. And those kinds of statements, that's what the court thought was relevant. When he got to the settlement of instructions, and we look at this from the standpoint of the judge, when he has all the evidence in front of him, he decided not to emphasize this. He saw this as something that was spontaneous, it's everyday language. He wanted to let it be, and he used jury instruction 46, and he didn't give any additional carefully drafted instructions as he initially anticipated. So there was no limiting instruction, as you pointed out, either by the defense. And I've covered Mr. Cady's ground. I don't know if the court has any other questions.
Yes. Counsel, can you speak a little bit about the evidence, if any, that came from the burn pit? Also, where was the burn pit located with reference to the defendant's residence?
Well, the burn pit is located behind Pride Neon Signs, which is close to the bike path and close to where the defendant, he was claiming that he fell in. He didn't have his jacket anymore because it got wet, because he fell in the river, and they were never able to confirm that. It's, I'm not sure how far away it would actually be from the home of the victim, but it's in the neighborhood. I think the bike path is to the west, based on the testimony and the record, and this site was one that was trouble in the past for this business owner. There are kids out there drinking, leaving beer cans, people who are putting refuse back there. What happened was that several weeks after this crime, when the news media had said, we're looking for fabric, this businessman had gone out there and he saw fabric in this area, no beer cans. He thought it was different. It was unusual. And what he backed away. He called the police, had them come out. They looked at the area. They could tell it was a fresh burn site. They couldn't tell what was in there. They've never been able to locate any of the fabric or any of the items that were in the victim's bedroom. Her bedroom was stripped. The bathroom was stripped. This gentleman who reported the tip indicated that he was concerned that something might be in that burn pit. Also, the defendant told his friend Mike that he burnt his flannel jacket so nobody would recognize him from the mosque video. So what this went to was the fact that Mr. Cady argued from the get-go in opening argument that there were leads in this case that weren't followed up on, things that weren't explored. They got this tip. They went out there step by step and looked at the burn pit to see what they could find. Now, ultimately, if you look at the testimony from Dreckman, who was one of the serologists in this case, and from Detective Hoffman, the resolution was that heat and fire degrades or destroys DNA evidence, so they weren't able to get any testing done on the items that were in there. They also weren't particularly critical items. They were a folded dollar bill, 12 cigarettes, and also a purple toothbrush. So that was what that evidence went in for, though, was to show how this was a complicated, all-hands-on-deck type of investigation, and that the police were doing their best, not from lack of trying. They couldn't identify everything that was turned into them of all those 270 or 297, I think it was, items that they estimated they found.
So Mr. Cady's argument seems to be that there's no probative value connected to the evidence regarding the burn pit.
That's true.
Was it error then to admit it?
Was it error to admit it? Not at all, because the trial court says, I see this as having foundation. And then he said there's some probative value because we have these two loose ends out there with a defendant who's covering his tracks. We have the loose end with the coat that got burned, and we have the loose end with the victim's items that, you know, we never could locate, anything that was in her bedroom or anything that was in her bathroom. And the court said there's some probative value. It goes to the weight of the evidence, and I'm going to let the jury decide what this means. So Mr. Cady probably doesn't think that it was important, but to the jury, it tells the story of this case and why they couldn't find things that they thought maybe might help them. So are there any further questions?
I guess not.
All right.
Nobody's criticized for quitting early.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Cady, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you. With regards to my client being a smart guy, let's take this in context of all the evidence that was there. We're dealing with someone who would buy an engagement ring for someone that he met a week before. That's not the best kind of long-term planning you can think of. We're dealing with someone who works labor at a flat rate of $100 per week, and he proudly stated to Detective Hoffman, "And I could work more hours if I wanted to." That's not the most sound economic kind of business plan there. This guy is no master criminal with that kind of thought process and that sort of kind of way of going about daily business. Now, there was much talk about, oh, that can't be the bike rider at 336 and 19 seconds. That can't be the defendant because we can't see his face. Well, you can't see the face of the individual walking in front of the mosque, presumably to the Kirkyard house. You can't see the face of the bike rider out in front of the 709 Garfield residence by the school, riding a bike with reflectors on. You can't see that person's face either. But we discount the bike rider that is inconvenient for the state's theory, that is driving on the same street of his girlfriend at approximately the time when he stated he was nearly run over by an SUV in his interview to Detective Hoffman.
So, counsel, that developed as the trial went on. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out procedurally what the steps were with regards to the alibi defense. So the state filed a notice of demand for alibi defense. You did not file a response.
That's correct.
You did not file a notice of intent to offer alibi defense.
That's correct.
And so did your alibi defense formulate through trial? Your client didn't testify. So
that's correct.
His explanation of his whereabouts came in through the police interviews.
Yes,
that were recorded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would proceed. I mean, procedurally, the evidence of the interviews. I think they first brought on the fact witnesses of people coming into the house and whatnot and discovering things, and then they went to the detectives, and then the interviews were introduced, and they're bringing on more police witnesses, and the fact that they didn't use Mixel to show the video made us take another hard look at it. And so we were just waiting for, after looking at it, we were noticing the commonality of it with much more precision, and then we decided to go into that specifically ourselves. That was in terms of the timing of it. But I think there's still, the Hibble case talks about there really isn't surprise when you're using, you're getting alibi evidence from the defendant. And the thing about this is that this stuff was known to the state because they gathered the evidence. They knew about it after they viewed it and picked it up. And I think purposely chose not to show it. And so we showed it, and it's something that goes along with the statements made by the defendant as to him being riding around, but not riding around at, not riding around at the decedent's residence if he's riding around elsewhere. And that confirms that one fraction in time. They gave a 7-hour window, and it's tough to try to come up with every second of every day. And then they try to expand it with an on or about instruction. With regards to the trial court being very careful to keep out evidence of the prior record, yes, he did order, you can't talk about it. Still came in, though. It came in from the detective, Detective Forrester, who said he got the defendant's number from his parole officer. We made motions for mistrial at various points in the case. And I understand that on appeal, trying to overturn a decision to deny a motion for mistrial is tough. Arguments are, well, they're probably figuring someone charged with murder is probably in jail. Okay. But if that's the case, once they hear that someone's has a parole officer, it's probably easy to think that a jury might figure out that they're on parole. And if they're on parole, they've probably got a felony. And so we need to take that and you pile it on top of the criminal mind evidence showing to show what he was doing with it, planning crimes. And then you put that on top of a denial of instructions to just say, this stuff is separate. Consider it, but consider that it does not necessarily mean a depraved mind. Consider everything else. That, I think, would have been helpful. And with regards to they never found anything stolen, that's an odd issue in this case, because there's some other things that present some odd fact issues. One is when the family reenters the dwelling after the first responders leave, there is discussion from a couple of witnesses. This is volume 6, the trial volumes, around 62, 82. They're talking about people coming in there and cleaning up, straightening things up, taking pictures, taking items. So we've got family members at a crime scene taking mementos. And yet he is, in relation to the burglary charges, is accused of these theft offenses. There was supposed to be $1,400 in the fridge. The initial sense was that he was going to be blamed for that. And then they pull that back. And so that just kind of goes with what the speculation is. Why there's so much speculation as to, was there a missing purse? If it was, did someone take it? Did the defendant take it? There's all this guesswork that you have to do, which is why I think the speculation and conjecture instructions that are in the appendix of my brief should have been granted to help sift through the 297 pieces of evidence that had nothing to do with the defendant's death. Those, I think, would have helped. And, in terms of sufficient evidence and whatnot, I think we need to consider certain things that the prosecutor said were certainties that could not be. There was an issue with the odor of bleach in the house and how it should have, I think it signifies that something happened on the crime scene. First responders, an EMT who was in the bathroom with the decedent in the tub, moving the decedent out of the tub, for 45 minutes, doesn't smell any bleach. The family smells bleach when they're coming. It's overpowering. Then when law enforcement officers like Detective Mertes comes back, there's this overwhelming smell of bleach. And the prosecutor explains that. I suggested something was happening when the family was there because the bleach smell doesn't arise any other time. The prosecutor said to the jury that there was no one there cleaning up, volume 12, page 85. And But, and the fumes came from the sides of the tub after the tub water was drained. So fumes must be coming from the side of the tub. And he said it was the only explanation because the house is too small and everyone would have seen someone cleaning. I think he's right. The house is too small. Someone would have seen someone cleaning. But consider an open, full bottle of bleach. Does it only smell? Does it only present an odor once it is emptied out due to the residue sticking to the sides? That's not the only explanation. The explanation I think that we suggested was the proper one. And so with those kind of inconsistencies and the errors that we're alleging to have occurred, that's why I'm talking about overwhelming evidence of guilt and reversible error and harmless error. It's because I think those errors contributed to warping the jury questions, the fact questions that they had to decide, which is why, you know, I bombarded you with all those issues, because you're looking at it collectively, there was problems in this case. Thank you very much. It's always an honor to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Coddy. The court, because we're on the internet, will be in recess till 11 o'clock. So we're in recess until that time, and I'd like a little bench conference in the corner with counsel. We're in recess.